Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, May 9th, 2019. A top U.S. diplomat in South Sudan urges the parties to the conflict to get serious in implementing the peace deal.
We cannot fund the upkeep of the military. This is something that's just off limits for us because, again, this is a military that has, for the past 5 years, conducted a civil war against its own citizens. So, of course, cannot support that.
And Save the Children says many South Sudanese children are still suffering.
So it's clearly that it's like most affected of conflict are children, and they're like, you know, in different ways. So it's not accessing basic services like health, nutrition or sanitation.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. ambassador to South Sudan says his government wants to see South Sudan's opposition and government leaders implement the revitalized peace deal without further delay, adding that both parties should be thinking beyond the timeline of the deal. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
U.S. Ambassador Tom Hasek says the five-year conflict has strained relations between Juba and Washington. He tells South Sudan in Focus the U.S. welcomes the former warring party's decision to extend the pre-transitional period by another 6 months, but says the U.S. now wants to see the parties to demonstrate practical steps in achieving results.
He used this 6 months wisely and actively to accomplish all the remaining tasks that need to be done in the pre-transition period, and even to start thinking about beyond.
The deal's original 8-month pre-transitional period that began in October would have expired this weekend. Little has been achieved by the parties in implementing key provisions of the deal during that time. Hasek insists the extension should not affect the timeline of the peace agreement, including holding national elections.
We made the point from the very beginning that if and when they considered a delay of the establishment of the transitional government, that they be very explicit, and that this will not cause a delay in the elections, which come at the end of the transition period.
Overall, the past few months, the parties repeatedly blamed delays in implementing security arrangements and other pre-transitional activities on a lack of funds. Late last month, it was revealed that the Kiir administration recently signed a 2-year contract worth $3.7 million with a U.S. lobbying firm to boost ties with the Trump administration and to block establishment of the hybrid court, which is part of the peace deal. Hasek and other high-ranking Western officials have denounced the contract. He says the U.S. government continues to fund humanitarian activities and organizations that monitor implementation of the peace deal, but Washington is not putting up money for security arrangements.
As far as providing assistance directly to the military in terms of security sector reform and in particular the question of cantonment, no, we cannot fund the upkeep of the military. This is something that's just off limits for us because, again, this is a military that has, for the past 5 years, conducted a civil war against its own citizens. So, of course, cannot support that.
Hasek says the U.S. wants to see South Sudan government release the $100 million it pledged this week to carry out pre-transitional activities spelled out in the deal, including security arrangements. The U.S. ambassador says the U.S. government wants South Sudan's leaders to implement the peace deal in letter and spirit, including provisions of all the justice mechanisms. He says the U.S. will be closely monitoring the situation in South Sudan and will be watching for any parties or individuals who obstruct the implementation of the peace deal.
If we need to, of course, we still can apply additional sanctions. For instance, if there are businesses that are still or corrupt individuals or businesses that are still, we find, are promoting conflict rather than peace. Yeah, people know that we, of course, we still have all the legal mechanisms and the ability to pursue sanctions if we need to.
The U.S. played a key diplomatic role in ensuring that the warring parties signed the deal last September. Despite its reservations about South Sudan's leaders, Washington remains the country's biggest aid donor. For VOA News, I'm Mwaki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The nonprofit Save the Children claims more than 1 million children are affected by the humanitarian crisis fueled by 5 years of conflict in South Sudan. That's according to a new report Save the Children released. A Save the Children specialist in South Sudan says fighting has robbed children of their ability to grow up in a peaceful environment. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
Save the Children child protection specialist Sylvia Onyati says the violent conflict and resulting widespread poverty and hunger has led to the displacement of more than 4 million people, with at least 1.5 million people located in places that have extremely limited access to humanitarian assistance due to insecurity. Onyati says nearly half of the country's internally displaced persons are children.
So it's clearly that it's like most affected of conflict are children, and they're like, you know, in different ways. So it's not accessing basic services like health, and nutrition or sanitation, but it's also on displacement. When we look at the numbers on 4.4 million either internally displaced or refugees, we see like half of them are children. As well, the impact on family separations affect children.
Save the Children registered more than 19,000 unaccompanied, separated, and missing children since the crisis began. Onyati says Save the Children has reunited more than 6,000 children with their families, but she says many children are still left vulnerable to forced labor, sex trafficking, and recruitment to the military by armed groups.
There's legal instruments, but there's like there's a need to have more advocacy for the implementation. And so one key area is on upholding laws and standards. Another area is on the access to justice for children and holding perpetrators to account. And the third key area, which is our core focus, is on the preventing and responding to violence against children.
Joseph Akech, Save the Children's Advocacy and Policy Director, says after holding group discussions with young girls in Akobo and Kopoita, researchers noticed that forced and early child marriages are on the rise in South Sudan because several families are still displaced. It's not unusual for parents to marry off their young daughters for bride wealth, according to Akech.
One of the factors that tend to tell us the prevalence of child marriage is communities that keep cattle. And we know where those communities are, partly because child marriage is associated with dowry. So when dowry is paid either in form of cattle or other forms, it seems to be always paid in cattle. Those communities tend to have high prevalence of child marriage. And the focus therefore is to work with those communities to understand that it's an acceptable form of engaging children. And not only does it impact on their livelihoods, but also their right to education and health.
Article 15 of South Sudan's transitional constitution states that no marriage shall be entered into without the free and full consent of the man and woman intending to marry. But Akech says the national transitional constitution does not state a minimum age for marriage, so child marriage continues unabated in South Sudan. He says Save the Children is working with other partners to draft a legal framework to address child marriages.
To ensure that laws protect and discourage child marriage are implemented, but in particular, we support a local partner to file a petition in court to ensure that Article 15 of the Constitution is amended, or that it comes clear what it means in terms of child marriage.
Onyati is calling on the government of South Sudan to strengthen the social fabric of society and educate communities on how to protect children. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Khartoum, where Sudan's protesters have condemned the military's demand to keep Sharia law as a source of legislation in Sudan's new constitution. The comments were in response to Sudan's transitional military council, saying it mostly agrees with the opposition's view for a short-term government, but that Sharia law was missing. Naba Mohyadin reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Sudan's Declaration of Freedom and Change forces an alliance of protest groups. On Wednesday, denounced the military's demand that Sharia law be part of a draft constitution. DFCF spokesman Abbas Madani said the military's raising the issue of Islamic law was irrelevant to talks on the constitution and an interim government, as well as dishonest. This is blackmail, he says, ideological blackmail. Those are the issues we are trying to overcome. We should establish the country using mutual dialogue, says Madani, not based on political orders. He notes the TMC had cancelled two protests by Salafists and Islamists since April 6 that were in support of Islamic Sharia law. Sudan's ruling Transitional Military Council, at a Tuesday night briefing, said it mostly agreed with the opposition's view on a draft constitution. But the TMC noted the draft materials made no mention of Islamic Sharia law. The council's spokesman, Lieutenant General Shamsuddin Kabashi, said they wanted Islamic Sharia laws and local norms to guide legislation. The document we received has omitted the sources of legislation. He says, our view is that Islamic Sharia and the local norms and tradition in the Republic of Sudan should be the sources of legislation. The military also disagreed with the opposition's suggestion that the cabinet should have the power to declare a state of emergency and that the transitional period should 4 years instead of two. The TMC said it could call for early elections within 6 months if they can't reach a final deal with Sudan's opposition. Sharia laws were firstly introduced to Sudan by former President Jafar Numeri in 1983. The move was supported by Sudan's Muslim majority, but alienated the Christian and enemy South and led to the Second Sudanese Civil War and South Sudan's eventual independence. Protesters like Muhammad Yunis are skeptical too, saying that Sharia law in constitutional legislation is a pretense for military rule. A civilian government will deal with the legislation and the constitution. He says, we are a Muslim majority. We will decide how Sharia will be handled, says Yunis. The issue of imposing Sharia laws and an Islamic constitution is the same facade of the 1989 Muslim Brotherhood regime, he says, and has nothing to do with Islam as a religion. The Transitional Military Council replaced former President Omar al-Bashir after the military ousted him from power on April 11. The coup came after 4 months of street protests against Bashir's 30-year rule that were sparked by food and fuel shortages. The protesters have continued to occupy central Khartoum and around the defense ministry, demanding the military hand power to civilians before its announced two-year transition. The two sides have agreed to form a joint military-civilian council, but can't agree on which gets the majority of seats. Sudanese protests and opposition leaders called on Wednesday for a nationwide strike in response to the military's proposals. Naba Mohyadin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Still in Sudan, the ongoing protests in Sudan have focused on political reforms and a demand for civilian rule. However, shopkeepers in the capital are hoping the ouster of long-time former President Omar al-Bashir will also boost the economy, which has labored for years under shortages and sanctions. Rud El-Mendrop has details from Khartoum.
We are in the living room of jeweler Hamid Ahmed while having breakfast. On a big round table there are plates with bread, cheese and olives. Both Hamid and his 7 children are enjoying this daily pleasure. Under Sudan's former President Omar al-Bashir, it was not easy for Ahmed to make enough money to put food on the table for everybody. But the cost of living under food and fuel shortages and 70% inflation sparked a revolution that removed Bashir from power and raised hopes for economic change. Ahmed is smiling when he tells how he feels about the revolution. He says that the Sudanese saying is, the air came. He adds that he feels better now because the people can work without anyone against them. In the old Arabic souk in central Khartoum is a maze of narrow streets with clothing shops, with men sitting in front of them, waiting for clients, drinking tea. Before Sudan's military ousted Bashir on April 11th, traders here were stressed by economic problems, but also lived in fear of the secret police. While having a cup of tea, trader Hassan Mohammed tells how life was. He says before the revolution there was no cash money, no freedom of speech and no rights. He says people were afraid to talk about politics. Bashir's removal and ongoing protests for civilian rule have inspired the people of Sudan and raised new hopes for traders like Ahmed. He says prices have improved and he hopes this market will keep improving after the revolution. The fruits of Sudan's revolution include billions of dollars in aid from the Middle East and a chance that the United States could lift a state sponsor of terrorism label, freeing access to loans. Since Bashir's ouster, the Sudanese pound has nearly doubled in value in black market trading against the dollar. But while Sudanese jeweler Ahmed looks forward to better sales, like the protesters, he also hopes for a civilian-led government and a better future for his children. Ruth Elmendorp for VOA News, Khartoum.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, traders in Jonglei State are coming to terms with losses during rainy season. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your least favorite thing about your country?
Corruption and nepotism.
Really, I say politics. The way things are conducted through politics in our country, in my country, really, it's not the actual way I really want them to be done.
Things are very expensive. Like the food, everything is expensive. School fees.
Unemployment. People hustling. I see many youths of my age. Like there are no jobs. People are broke. We see that the guys who are so broke, and we see the people that have money.
Corruption, basically, which is done by the leaders themselves, you know. They are showing a bad example, especially to the young generation who are coming or who are going to be leaders of tomorrow.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Traders in Jonglei State capital Bor are coming to terms with losses after heavy rains and high winds destroyed dozens of small grocery stores and market stalls across the town overnight. A spokesman for the Jonglei State Chamber of Commerce says the storm destroyed essential food items worth millions of South Sudanese pounds. Deng Gaideng has the story for VOA from Bor.
Traders spend most of the day either removing damaged food items like sugar and flour and other goods or pulling down their mostly destroyed makeshift structures. Both traders hurriedly nail down iron sheets onto timber, racing to repair shops and stalls as more storms were expected to hit the area. Speaking in Dinka, 38-year-old Madin Anyang Madit, who owns a small grocery shop in Maro Market, says he lost goods worth more than 60,000 South Sudanese pounds.
All the goods that I had in this shop have been destroyed. The maize flour has been damaged. Beans, cooking oil and onions. Almost everything here is destroyed. The wind was really very strong.
Kurmajak Nyal, another trader who owns a food store in Maror Market, says he too lost nearly everything in last night's storm.
The wind came and destroyed all the shops. My shop currently is open, so the rain has destroyed everything in the shop. Yeah, yet we have not calculated. We are now in to do our jobs. Like we are now on a betting as you are out of the hammers. So we are still doing our job, then we are going to calculate the losses. So yet we have not yet calculated. To tell my people that loss is lost. But whoever has got lost has also has to make himself strong and work on his own, because we have nowhere to go.
Speaking in Dinka, 48-year-old Bo town resident Aluela Bolich says the heavy rain and winds destroyed her entire house and all of its belongings.
It rained very badly last night. We were just praying to God as it rained, because we don't know what happened this year, why it rained with such a storm. Houses have been destroyed, but thank God we are safe.
Mabiur Kuala Juk, a spokesman for the Jonglei State Chamber of Commerce, says 46 makeshift shops built with iron sheets were destroyed in the storm. Speaking in Arabic, Kual says the losses for traders in Bo town total more than 3 million South Sudanese pounds.
Lano alhawal kan jasa sita unus o azeno ful marwarwan inde na sitacha dukan.
We have 16 shops destroyed in Marwarwan. We have 12 shops in Marwar 2, 12 shops in Langbar, and 8 shops in that site of Akwot Ayol. All the goods in those shops like flour, sugar, beans, and others, these are things that are finished.
Kual says traders are likely to hike prices of basic food items in the coming days to try and recover the cost of lost items. But he strongly advised traders not to do that.
I
want to tell the traders that don't increase the prices, because this is a natural disaster. Nobody brought it, so let's not increase the prices so that common citizens cannot suffer.
Residents and traders are calling on state officials to provide financial assistance, but in South Sudan, it is rare for local government agencies to provide financial aid for a storm damage. Atong Kual Manyang is the Jonglei State Information Minister.
Yesterday's rain, it had a bit of damage on especially certain shops.
Kual says Jonglei officials will assess the destruction caused by the last night's storm and will try to provide assistance. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaiding, reporting from Bor.
South Africa's Electoral Commission counted votes Thursday, the day after a parliamentary poll that was expected to be the toughest test yet for the long-running African National Congress. Initial results show the ANC ahead, but with a much slimmer lead than in previous elections. VOA's Anita Paul reports from Johannesburg.
This was predicted to be a dramatic vote for the Rainbow Nation, which is marking 25 years after the end of apartheid. As election officials trudged through millions of votes Thursday, they announced they would urgently conduct an audit into allegations that some citizens may have voted more than once by removing the indelible ink placed on every voter's thumb. Officials say four people had been arrested for double voting. Political analysts gave mixed reactions to the audit announcement. Ralph Mateja says he is concerned the move could delay results and have serious consequences.
It's a big deal. We have not seen this before. We're opening floodgate, because this is not doing all this audit. Everybody else is going to complain. And when you hear that election results are no longer going to be announced on Saturday and when, for me, it's a crisis.
Analyst Angelo Fick says he is less concerned.
The audit that's just been announced by the ISC, I think, is a measure of their confidence in the fact that their systems have worked. So they're fairly confident that there has been no problem and will now seek independent confirmation of that.
In the most populous province, Gauteng, the IEC's Boitumelo Monaki told VOA that officials were responsive to concerns about possible fraud.
I can confirm that counting is going well at our voting centers around the province. And then where there are cases of fraud whereby double voting is being reported, the Electoral Commission is requesting political parties to bring evidence of that so that the matter can be investigated.
The long-ruling ANC is expected to win the greatest number of votes, followed by the opposition Democratic Alliance and the upstart far-left Economic Freedom Fighters Party. Corruption scandals and the sluggish economy have tainted the ANC's image and led some voters to defect. What surprised many pollsters was the success of the Afrikaans-speaking VF Plus Party, whose English name is Freedom Front Plus. The party's aim is to create a homeland for the nation's white, Afrikaans-speaking minority. The party surged into fourth place in early counts, eclipsing its 1% take in the 2014 election. Vic.
It is, I think, an electoral surprise, but it isn't a political surprise that the Freedom Front Plus has increased its share of the vote in South Africa. We have seen a growing disaffection among people who identify in conservative circles and on the far right with the way in which the official opposition and other parties that they may have supported have behaved over the last 5 years.
Election officials assured voters they will be able to release final results within the 7 days allowed by law. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Uganda's singer and legislator known as Bobi Wine has vowed to continue using music to denounce long-term President Yoweri Museveni. Wine, whose real name is Robert Kyagulanyi, received a heroic welcome last week after spending 3 nights in prison over a street protest. But as Alima Athumani reports from Kampala, his music is increasingly facing censorship from the state.
We are fighting for freedom. We are living in a time similar to the one of slave trade. This operation is worse than apartheid.
Bobi Wine has been singing and entertaining Ugandans since he was a teenager. Now 37 and a member of parliament, his songs today carry a political message. Wine, whose real name is Robert Kyagulanyi, says it's time for the country's young people to awaken and challenge President Museveni.
Our message has been primarily a message of mental emancipation, of knowing that Ugandans are actually the owners of this country and the leaders must do everything they do in the benefit of the people, which is not the case here today.
It's rare that Wine gets to sing these days. Since 2017, more than 120 planned of his concerts have been cancelled by the police, who says his management failed to meet minimum security standards required to host revelers. To stop his concerts, police have used arrests and tear gas to clear the crowds. Wine supporters, such as Chifampa Nsambu, are not happy.
He's singing about the Ugandan who is suffering, and he's talking about the reality on ground. Those who are living in posh houses and posh cars, moving in AC cars, they do not feel the situation that is happening here. But it is the government that is destroying the peace that is here.
And a house arrest, the musician once again turned to his music to send a message to the police.
You're breaking my hand, officer. I'm not fighting you, my brother. Why are you hurting me?
Why you beating me? Na missing at a fault in our way. Why you kicking me?
His message, I am fighting for you and not against you. Days later, he was arrested again on charges of unlawfully engaging in a protest against Uganda's 2018 social media attacks. He was released on bail. Political analyst Miriam Matembe says the message of Bobi Wine's music helped get him elected to the legislature.
They elected him because they believe in what he stands for. Now, why should you brutalize him, torture him, simply because you fear that he's threatening your position as the president of Uganda.
Solomon Sirwanyi, deputy chief whip of the ruling National Resistance Movement Party, says he does not have a problem with Wine as long as he can differentiate between music and politics.
Of course, as a musician, I support Bobi Wine so much. I love the music, I support his music. But as a president of Uganda, of course, I don't support him. I support President Museveni because I believe he still has a vision for this country.
Halima Athumani for VOA News, Kampala.
That report by Halima Athumani brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Okanga by a group from Wau State. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Zata zaman ni ba kwa zaliwe.